And we are back. As promised, I have invited Matthew Shapiro with Rice Rose. That is the law firm. Website, ricerose.com. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, Dave. Thanks for having me. Excited
Glad
to
have you back. You are now an experienced veteran of radio.
Well, I'll tell you what. Today, the sequel is going to be as good as the original,
is
if
it?
Not better.
All right.
I'm
well,
excited.
We're ready for... I already had a preview. I know what you're going to talk about. I'm excited because I think it's a very interesting subject, and it's one that is extraordinarily misunderstood. Almost as, you know, a lot of stuff about basics of wills and trusts and all these things that people really should have in place so that there is clarity and expediency and efficiency of distributing and getting their estate to their family and friends or whoever. But this subject you have for us today, I'll let you all, you have a drum roll, Lisa? All right. She's magical. But the topic for today, go ahead.
All right. Today we're going to be talking about how to contest or prevent a contest issue on a will or a trust. Dealing with things such as procedural issues, capacity, undue influence. So we'll be talking all about those things today and how you can either prevent it or if you believe someone may have been the victim of it, how to spot that and what you need to do.
Okay, very good. So when you say contest, this isn't some weird pronunciation of a contest between parties, but it could be. Contesting a will or trust is where somebody says, look, this thing is not valid. Whoever is getting something from this document shouldn't be getting it.
Exactly. The idea of setting aside the document, whether it's the will or the trust, and either going to a previous one that may have been established at a different point in time, or going to what the default would be under the law, intestacy is the name for the statute, those ideas. So again, it's taking what's there and saying, court, you need to set this aside. It shouldn't be here for a certain reason.
Okay. So let me get back in there just real quick. Matthew is with Rice and Rose, and the firm is Rice Rose Law, the website.com. 257-1222?
Good memory.
Very good. Very good. All right. Thank you. Well, I call Matthew now and then and just call to harass him and bother him. Actually, he's done work for our clients in the estate and trust area and done a good job. And so let's start with the basic concept, and that is that let's start from the standpoint of somebody has, and what you see, I'm sure you can give us some examples, Matthew, but basically somebody is being cut out or not provided by virtue of a will or a trust, one of these estate planning documents. That's what creates the problem.
Well, that's always going to be at the root of it. The idea is that you're going to have someone, the person contesting it, that believes that the way things have been set up is not how either the parent, the spouse, how that person in question intended it to go, and therefore the idea is something must have gone wrong along the way.
Okay, so there, now this is where we need to distinguish from what you see on television. Let's rewind a little bit. Let's go with what is the impetus for this, which is somebody has died. Because you can't really challenge it until the person dies, right? I mean, there's nothing to, I mean, you could get involved and say, look, you know, what's going on? And I suppose ask the court to intercede in some fashion.
Well, you know, that's a really, really good point you brought up. And that's something that most people don't understand. You actually don't have any cause of action, which is the legal term for the ability to bring a lawsuit until the person passes. Because a will or a trust, in most cases, there's some exceptions with the trust, but in most cases, these documents are revocable and can be changed at any time up until the person passes. So this idea that, well, I know the second husband has might have been fiddling with mom's will. Well, there's nothing you can technically do about that unless you're getting into some ideas of what's called an elderly abuse, some criminal
right,
issues.
Right, right.
But for the most part, there actually is no cause of action until that instrument is triggered and finalized, because the law is going to look at it as well. Mom can always change her mind and put you back in it. So,
and you haven't been hurt yet.
That's a very good point.
You haven't been, you haven't been alienated yet. We all grew up, you know, seeing this on television. A basic thing, the reading of a will. Does that, you know, does that happen? How does it happen? Is it required to happen? Does it get everybody together? Everybody sits in the big chairs and we all have this official reading by the attorney. How does that work?
Well, you know, every case is really different and it often depends. Most times, most cases, the client has already shared with their intended beneficiaries what's going to happen.
So it's sharing with the beneficiaries.
And I would always recommend that. I tell people, some people, they don't want the intended beneficiaries to know how much money they're going to receive. And I completely respect that as an attorney and someone who's seen this. You don't necessarily want your children to know exactly what they're going to get. But the idea of nonetheless telling them, my general idea is that you are to receive something, your brother's to receive something, your sister's to receive something.
So be on the lookout for something.
Yeah, to know. And oftentimes that's what happens if you have a child, and I'm using just children as an example here, who's been disinherited and they're not told of that ahead of time. Well, that's one of the number one things that triggers the idea of something must have gone wrong. Someone must have influenced the parent in that situation. What I always tell clients is, share with your children what the general plan is. You don't have to get into specifics. But
you and your brother are going to split it 50-50, whatever's mm-hmm. left. Whatever we don't spend, okay, traveling around the world, you're going to get 50-50.
Right, hopefully, yeah.
I mean, that's basically the message. You don't have to say you're going to get, you know, the Smith-Barney account, the Holland Financial account, the insurance policy. You don't have to get into specifics. You can say, generally speaking, that's what you're going
to
get.
Right, and so when you put someone on notice, it's generally one of those things you can do to give a heads up and perhaps avoid a contest issue down the road.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back. Matthew Shapiro is in the studio with us, ricerosalaw.com, 257-1222. Quick break, right back. Stay right there.
If you had a serious health issue, wouldn't you want a second opinion? Is your financial well-being any different? Make sure your retirement plan is the best it can be for your situation. An independent financial advisor can review key elements like stock market exposure, diversification, and fees. Holland Financial is ready to help. Call 888-747-PLAN to schedule your free consultation or visit us at davidholland.com.
And we're back. Matthew Shapiro, ricerosalaw.com, Rice Row Law Firm, and 257-1222 is the number. So just for a second longer, indulge me, Matthew. So, okay, so let's just break it down. Real simple. Somebody's, a family member dies. Okay, let's just say, you know, a parent. And it was the surviving parent, so it's the last of the parents to die. Two sons get together and say, okay, there's one of them is named personal representative. Or maybe a friend of the family. Let's use that
right.
as a better example.
It happens.
Let's say a friend of the family's been named personal representative. What then happens? Should those two sons expect then to be communicated with and to be told what they're getting? And if that's true, what if, you know, it's 75-25? Does the personal representative have to tell each of them what the other one's getting or just tell them what they're supposed to get?
Well, again, it really depends. As far as who's notified, the way it'll work is, let's say you have a scenario where everyone understands what's in the will. They can all come into the attorney's office, and at that point in time, there'll be a general reading. But I guess what you're more getting to is, what if you have one brother who lives off in Washington and
right.
someone here in Florida, and the question is who has what? When you enter a will into probate, which we talked about last time, that's the process where you officially pay off the creditors, change the assets, give them to the beneficiaries. At that point in time, a notice is always sent out to all the intended beneficiaries, anyone who may be a beneficiary. And at that point, they have access to see what's in the will, what
they're entitled
to. So
they can see the whole will?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
If they are a beneficiary, they can see the whole thing?
Yes.
If they're not a beneficiary, they're not entitled to see
it? Well, that's not necessarily true, because now
okay.
probate is generally public record, unless you are dealing with certain things where for some reason it might be sealed. Typically some guardianship issues sprinkled in there, mental health issues.
Okay.
But generally speaking, probate, people can see will even if they're not in it or a party to it. That's all public
access.
That's
one of the deficiencies of the probate process is the lack of privacy.
Right, which is why some people choose to go with a trust. But yes, so to answer your question, there's a lot of transparency with it, and that's what leads people to say, well, wait a minute, I'm only getting X percent and so-and-so's getting Y. Something might have gone wrong along the way.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay, so let's say then that that's all happened and there's this reading, everything's going on. Let's say somebody says, hey, wait a minute, I'm not getting what I thought I would get or what mom told me I was going to get, right? The difference between what's been communicated and what's actually in the will. What does somebody do who thinks that something's gone wrong? What is their first step?
Well, the first step I would obviously recommend is consult with an attorney. And
a good one.
A good one. And to see what the attorney believes their chances of success are. I tell people anyone can sue over anything at any time. That doesn't mean you're going to necessarily succeed on it. So obviously
yeah,
you want to know.
And it might get turned around on you for a frivolous
right,
lawsuit.
Right.
And,
there are certainly, certainly things in place for that. So you always want to see what your chances of success are as far as the circumstances leading up to the will. Have someone assess the situation. Remove the emotion from it. These are very emotional things. It's very similar to family law, and the person who made the will isn't alive anymore, so you can't go to them and say, why did this happen? What was your thought process? So I'd highly recommend you consult with someone, and they can kind of go through the various ways you can actually contest a will or a trust.
Now, what are the primary ways somebody would use, I guess, what would be the arguments, the aspects that would exist that they would say, okay, because of these things, you know, it should be either go back to a previous will or it should just go to the default.
Well, there are three main ways, and the first one's real brief, and that's where the procedure's followed correctly. In Florida, you have to have a written will, nothing oral. It can be written on a napkin, a tablecloth, that's fine, but it has to be in writing, signed by the person drafting the will, by the person devising the property, and then witnessed. by two people, and those witnesses have to see the entirety of the writing and what happened. So you need to have the proper mechanisms in place to get that done. Usually, as long as you've consulted with an attorney, you're going to be fine on that area, but it is something to be aware of that if you don't draft it properly, get it sealed properly, that's the number one easiest way to have it set aside.
Okay, so basically, if you don't have a properly executed will, and that may be something that a good example would be, you know, the will is all the same font for the first 8 pages, and then the signature page is a different font and a different style, and it's been put on the back, so it's almost like something might not have been done correctly.
Well, that certainly raises a red flag. I'll tell you the most common one where people mess up is they put it in writing, type it up, sign it, put it away. Well, you don't have your two witnesses right there. So things like that, people need to be aware of the procedural requirements.
So that's not going to hold up. That might be a reason to say to go back to a previous will or go to the default in the state, which is, what is it called again?
Intestacy.
Do they take you aside in law school to teach you all these odd words,
I'll tell you, Dave, the first year is very fun, learning all the Latin.
And, I was going to say, don't you have to have Latin to get to law
school?
Some
of the more antiquated sayings still exist to this day. But Yes, absolutely. Well, I'll tell you, the two most common ones, though, which you really get into is lack of capacity and undue influence. And they often go hand in hand because the idea is, generally, if you have a strong capacity, what are the chances of someone exerting their will over you? Although it happens, there can be things, fraud or certain levels of coercion. But one of the things we do when someone comes in, if there's any issue of any doubt as to capacity, we always have them get a doctor's note before executing. That's the number one thing you can do. That nips any lawsuit in the bud. If you can have someone say, here's the doctor, they met with them at noon, doctor said they have capacity, they came into our office at 1 and executed the instrument.
That's pretty clear cut.
Good luck trying to overturn
that. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. Matthew Shapiro is in the studio with us, Rice Rose Law Firm, 257-1222. We'll be right back.
There are hundreds of annuities available in today's marketplace. How can you know if one is right for you? Certified financial planner David Holland answers this question and more in his educational booklet on annuities. To get your free copy, call Holland Financial at 888-747-PLAN. The annuity booklet provides a plain English explanation of the different types of annuities so you can decide if one is a good fit for your situation. Again, that number is 888-747-7526.
We're back with Matthew Shapiro, RiceRoseLaw.com, Rice Rose Law Firm, 257-1222. We're talking about the ways to challenge will or trust where you feel like somebody has not, something's gone wrong, something's rotten in Denmark. You mentioned the lack of capacity, and you gave the example of, you know, if you want to make sure that this is not something that somebody challenges, or you want to make sure it's clear, you want to have it be really clear for your family and your beneficiaries, and if there is any question at all, you know, maybe mom has bad days and good days.
Err on the side of caution.
So she goes to the doctor, preferably the same day, and then what does the doctor say? I've examined Mrs. Smith and find her to be in good working order, and she's good to go, and she's the proper terminology for basically saying she's competent.
That's the start, and then two, you know, there's a three-pronged test the law will generally apply, and the first is you want to make sure the person understands the nature and extent of their property, and that's just a simple conversation you have with them. What is it you own, Mrs. Smith? You know, what's the extent of your estate? You want to make sure someone can actually explain to you what it is they own. The second would be, do they understand the relation to those in their family or those in the will? Do they get who their children are? Do they understand who's in their family? And finally, do they understand the effect of what it is they're doing? Are they able to conceive the fact that, let's say, they're disinheriting a child, what that means and what that entails? So I'll generally, if a doctor reaches out to us and says, what is it you need in this note, I'll say, I want to understand and know from you that they understand their basic family
relationship. So this is something the doctor is going to ask them. What you just described there, what you got, who do you want to give it to, and what that means, those are things the doctor might ask?
They might. Some doctors have more experience in this area than others. They've been through this before in terms of having to prepare an opinion, and others it might be their first time, so they'll give a call to the office. So it'll really depend on that nature. And, you know, you mentioned the fact mom has good days, mom has bad days, and I want the listeners to understand, just because someone's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's or early onset dementia or something to that extent, you're not precluded for making a will. You just have to make sure you have the capacity at that time and at that moment.
On that day and at that moment.
That's correct.
So you literally could have mom or dad or whoever it is could have a lot of bad days, but they have a great day. They see the doctor. Doctor says, you're good. meet with the attorney. The attorney says, okay, we're going to execute this will, and you go through the same questions and you make sure they understand what they're doing.
Absolutely.
And that's going to hold.
Absolutely.
Now, it can still be challenged, of course, but that's going to be pretty tight.
You've laid the foundation, and a tight one at that, as you use the phrase. So, I mean, that's something I would always recommend to people. If there's any question as to capacity, even if you haven't been diagnosed with anything, if you've got someone out there who's 85, 90 years old, and what they want to do might upset people. Now, if they come in and they say, I have two children, I want to leave everything to both of them 50%. I mean, that's not something that obviously raises a red flag and you need to worry so much about the capacity. But anytime you have one of those red flag scenarios where
something's different or unusual,
a little bit different or outside the box, it's when you really want to touch upon that capacity issue.
So if somebody has capacity, they literally, Matthew, can do anything they want. I mean, it's their money. It's their ability to craft these documents with the help of the attorney and your advice. So if somebody wants to leave, you know, everything they've got to the Tibetan monks, it's their choice.
Just about. Okay. The law is going to step in a few instances.
Okay.
The main one is if you have a spouse. Okay. There's something called elective share, where if you basically disinherit your spouse, they're entitled to a certain percentage of your. It's around
30%.
Yeah, 30%, okay. I believe, or very close there to it. And that is broader than what's in your probate. That includes things, bank accounts that might have someone else's name on them, life
IRAs,
insurance policies. Yeah, it's
annuities,
much broader.
Okay.
So
basically, the spouse can basically take 30 or 33%, whatever it is, of everything that person basically has some ownership in.
Right. So, I mean, they're fine
they
with you.
They take the greater of.
Right. They're exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Take what you left me, or I'll take the third.
Yeah. So, the law will let you leave to charity, but things in another instance would be homestead property if you've got a minor child. There's public policy issues where they don't want spouses and minor children becoming wards of the state, more or less. So in that sense, the law is not going to let you do that. But more or less, I mean, if you don't have a spouse and your kids are grown up and you want to leave it to the neighbor, you want to leave it to charity, or
I've seen that happen.
Or Florida State football, that's fine too. You can do all those great things.
Well, don't stretch too far, but it'll work out okay. All right, we need to take another quick break. Matthew Shapiro is our guest, attorney and avid Florida State football fan, as you can hear. 257-1222 is the telephone number, and Rice Rose Law Firm, ricerose.com for the website. Stay right there.
Sometimes I know what I want to say, but just can't find the words.
Last week I shouted at my grandson, and I'm not sure why.
I saw my daughter, but couldn't remember her name.
The sooner you recognize the warning signs of Alzheimer's disease, the sooner you can do something about it. To learn more, go to alz.org/10signs. That's alz.org/10signs. A message from the Alzheimer's Association.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Matthew Shapiro, Florida State football fan, we found out before the break. A very good attorney locally here in Volusia County, Rice Rose Law, and the website ricerosedlaw.com, 257-1222. Talking about contesting wills and trusts. This not only applies to wills, but also trust documents.
Yes, anything we're talking about here today, it's the same issue, same test for capacity, same execution requirement. So even though I might just be saying will, we're also referring to trust under this scenario.
Would you also use, because I think this will be another relevant thing, let's say somebody's got, again, we've got one parent who's the surviving parent, they die, and let's say that you've got three kids, and there's a will that leaves money. One third, one third, one third. Everybody's, you know, share and share alike. But then there's some other separate property. Let's say that you mentioned a bank account or something with the POD, mm-hmm. the paid on death provision. Let's say that there's a $50,000 CD that goes to one of the kids.
Right.
And the two that didn't get that are scratching their head.
Well, there are certain claims you can do with that one. If something cannot be fixed in probate, you can bring what's called tortious interference with inheritance. And that's basically the cause of action if it's not something where it's a will contest.
Okay, so it's the same principle, same concept.
Just a different way of getting
there. Okay, so you say basically, hey, look, my brother, he got mom to put that CD, to set up that provision, and told her that he would make sure that we got it, but he did it just so he would get it. And it, obviously, if it's done by a beneficiary designation or one of these paid on death provisions, then it's not subject to the will. So he's
right. He's circumventing probate.
He's done his tortious interference.
Yeah. And you know, that really brings me to the next point, that idea of undue influence. And there are certain tests associated with that. And really what you're looking for in an undue influence scenario is, do you have one, a substantial beneficiary? It has to be someone who's getting a lot under the change. And this is something I've seen in practice before. You have someone, well, real quick, the second prong is confidential relationship. And the third one is active procurement. So let's say you have someone let's say a son, okay, confidential relationship. They take mom or dad into the lawyer. They're the one who's there. They're present. But they have the will changed, so it all goes to charity. Well, they're not becoming a substantial beneficiary of that altered will. So you really have to look for these three prongs in conjunction. They're going to get a lot on the will, substantial beneficiary. They actively procured the change. And three, they're in a confidential relationship with the person. It's not John Smith off the street who mom or dad hired to have them take them into the lawyer's office. When you have all these three things together, what happens is a presumption is raised that undue influence was present, and then it's on the burden shifts to the person who wants the will to be entered into probate to rebut that. But those are the three red flags you're really looking for in the court.
Okay, so those three things basically are what's going to say, okay, there could be undue influence.
Yes.
Okay. Interesting. What else do you see that kind of comes up in this whole process? I guess, you know, we talked earlier about how somebody can avoid this happening in their family. And of course, that's to go through this process of making sure everything is crystal clear and that, you know, you're competent and you've done all that. Anything else about this that you've seen be difficult for families?
Well, I'd say, one of the common things, and it doesn't necessarily tie into the undue influence, is unintentional disinheriting.
Ah.
That's one of the things you run into with these boilerplate forms that you can purchase places. A quick example would be the order of funds being depleted. Let's say there's creditors. In your will, you can give someone what's called a specific devise, I give you my house, or residuary devise saying I give you everything that remains, and the residuary goes first. So if you give house to son, everything else to daughter, and they're of equal value, and the creditor goes ahead and depletes the residuary, well, someone's getting a house and someone's getting nothing. So those are other things.
Residual.
Those are other things it helps when you can talk to someone about and explore those options. So there are a couple of pitfalls certainly along the way to look out for.
Okay, Matthew, we're out of time. Matthew Shapiro, ricerosenlaw.com, 257-1222. We'll have you back again soon.
I look forward to
it. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Want to learn more about Real Money with David Holland? Visit us at realmoneyradio.com, where you can listen live or to the archives. You can also email us your questions, comments, or show ideas to info@realmoneyradio.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook at Real Money with David Holland and keep up with Scott Connor by following us on Twitter at Real Money Radio.
Remember, nobody cares more about your money than you do. This has been Real Money with David Holland. Thank you for listening.